Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, acknowledging the vital work of local public health departments to keep Californians safe during the pandemic. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. With the Creek Fire still raging, we talk today with fire scientists about the future of our forest and the impact of climate change. Plus, we introduce you to a new series about the 2020 election that compares two neighboring counties, LA and Kern. And yes, they do have some common ground. But first, last Tuesday, more than 150 hikers and backpackers had to be evacuated from the High Sierra by helicopter. What was it like to be stranded by the Creek Fire? FM89's Laura Satsui spoke to some of those who waited it out at the Vermilion Valley Resort on Lake Edison.
When James Wade Sponsler and two friends set out on a backpacking trip Friday night over Labor Day weekend, they didn't know a fire had started 30 miles away.
Just about lunchtime on Saturdays when we noticed a massive thunderhead, unbeknownst to us, this was actually the fire itself.
The three have been hiking portions of the 214-mile-long John Muir Trail over the last few years, and this was the first time they'd hit the trail together all summer. Last year, they hiked through a downpour, so they were ready to push through what looked like more rain. They arrived at Rosemary Meadow right on schedule Saturday night and set up camp. Sunday morning, they woke up to smoke.
The best way of describing it is like fog. It was smoke, and we never, ever, ever saw fire. All we saw was smoke.
That's Albert Yergel, one of Sponsler's backpacking buddies. They met, by the way, through Boy Scouts.
So I checked my spot communication device, which is a satellite pager, and my wife is trying to contact me. Without even reading it, I went, oh,
He knew there was a serious problem. Her message? The forest was on fire. Instead of taking 2 days to finish the hike as planned, the group covered 13 miles in one day, hoping they could get home before the fire got any worse. But once they returned to their cars...
And there's a note on there from the ranger saying the road closed at 4 o'clock.
Their cars were at Vermilion Valley Resort on Lake Edison, so they decided to settle in. Other hikers and backpackers stranded by the blaze joined them. The resort was a rendezvous point, not in the path of the Creek Fire at the time, so they were safe. Riley Budd, a third member of Sponsler's crew, says waiting for the helicopters wasn't the most stressful part of being stranded at the resort.
As soon as we got into VVR on Sunday night, after that long day of hiking, several people were running around the campsite because a man had passed unconscious.
Bud is CPR certified, so he went to help.
And that was one of the most overwhelming experiences I've had in my life. I was very focused in the moment and wasn't freaking out or anything while I was doing CPR. Right after, I was very overwhelmed.
The man Bud tried to revive passed away. On Monday, the three filled in for the resort's kitchen staff. There was a skeleton crew working because of the fire. For dinner, Sponsler and his friends went way beyond trail mix. They prepared tri-tip, risotto, and roasted pan-seared bacon garlic green beans.
We ate really good for being in an evacuation camp.
By dinner time, the group had also made a roster of everyone there and started mapping a route out should they have to hike away from the fire to the eastern side of the Sierra. It would be a 20-plus mile trek. Sponsler says having things to do kept him calm, but no hike was necessary. On Tuesday morning, just after 3 a.m., the smoke cleared enough for helicopters to land at Lake Edison and bring them back to Fresno. In retrospect, Sponsler says it felt right that they were there.
It's appropriate that it happened the week of 9/11. It kind of gave me that sense that, you know, where people came together again in a time where we're more fractured than we ever have been today.
even with that optimism, though, Sponsler says he's done with 2020.
I wrote in the ash on the back of my car, 2020 can suck it. And that's exactly what it says.
Riley Budd agrees.
Here we all were trying to get away from the hustle and bustle of daily life and try to get a little break from all the stuff that's been going on in 2020, only for the year to hit us once again with a solid uppercut.
However, Albert Yergel says, in a way, it was the best kind of adventure.
We never, ever were in any danger, except when Wade almost got bit by a rattlesnake, but that doesn't count.
The three say they're still planning to finish hiking the John Muir Trail. They have two segments left. They say they'll hike them as early as possible in 2021. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Laura Satsui.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. 2 weeks ago today, the Creek Fire broke out in the Sierra National Forest. It's been destroying property and pumping smoke and ash into the air ever since. Joined now by the Bulldog Fire in the Dinky Lakes Wilderness and the Sequoia Complex Fire, which is currently threatening the town of Three Rivers in Tulare County. To better understand why this year's wildfires are so large, numerous, and devastating, I spoke with Mike Thune, Fire Information Officer for the Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks, Adam Hernandez, Wildland Fire Technology Instructor at Reedley College, and John Abatsoglu, Associate Professor of Climatology at UC Merced. John, I'd like to start with you. You study drought and fire and the impact of climate on the West. How predictable was this fire season?
Elements of this season were quite predictable, unfortunately. The ingredients for a large fire season have been being built over the past several years. And in this year in particular, we've had a very warm year. We had low precipitation year across much of Northern California and into Oregon. And that, along with a couple pretty high-level critical fire weather events, really set the stage for this. So even though we are talking about an unprecedented fire season in the modern record, it's unfortunately a little bit predictable. We knew that one of these years we would see a year like this. So I think that we are surprised. There's a lot of impact, but the reality is we sort of knew this was coming.
So I would like to dive into some specifics about the fires that are currently happening here in the Valley. And Mike Thune, I'd like to shift the conversation to you. What can you tell us about where things stand with the Sequoia Complex Fire? And I should note that we are having this conversation on Thursday afternoon, and I appreciate the fact that these fires move fast and conditions change quickly. But if you could give us a general sense of where things stand, I think that would be helpful.
Sure. This is Mike Thune. When it comes to the Sequoia Complex, or the SQF Complex as it's formally known, things with that fire are very dynamic. You're looking at a large-scale wildfire that's over 100,000 acres that's not only impacting areas locally, but also it's impacting the entire region when it comes to air quality. And so these wildfires that you're seeing across the Sierra Nevada aren't just isolated to those communities they're directly impacting, but those wildfires are also having a huge impact all across the state and even places outside of California.
And where do things stand as it pertains to resources?
When you look at the resources for the SQF complex, there's over 1,000 personnel assigned. And when you look at the whole nation, as of this past week, there were over 30,000 people assigned to fires across the United States. That's a lot of resources that are looking at fighting these wildfires, but it also shows how many wildfires there are across the entire nation.
Adam Hernandez, you spent 17 years working with fire in the Sierra Forest, and I'm hearing from those who are fighting the Creek Fire that they have never seen fire behave the way this fire has. What makes it so different?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of factors that come into play, from climate to fuel loading, to some of these, record-breaking weather trends that we've been having this summer, the low precipitation, and just the complexity of the terrain that these fires are starting in. And then, on top of that, the initial attack response and having folks at the ready when these fires are starting and there's already multiple large incidents across the state, things are spread very thin. And so it makes it difficult to get that initial attack response on these fires and get a grasp on them early. And then even once you do get folks on the fire lines, you know, they're faced with tons of challenges with, you know, resistance to control due to the large fuel loadings, and then just temperatures and conditions of fuel dryness that just, you know, propagate spotting and fire movement that's very aggressive. So it makes it challenging. There's lots of layers that are all kind of putting everything into alignment and creating a lot of challenges for the suppression folks on the ground.
I'd like to get into some of those layers. And John Abatsoglu, I'm going to point this conversation toward you. Given that you research how climate affects wildfire behavior, water, and agriculture, how has weather contributed to the fire outbreak that we're seeing, not just here in the Valley, but throughout the Western United States?
Yeah, weather and climate are two of the more dynamic elements that contribute to fire activity. Either weather through the combination of strong winds, a very unstable atmosphere that promotes plume growth that we've seen recently on some of these fires locally, and then, of course, sort of year-to-year variability in terms of how dry fuels are, and then in some cases, sort of the buildup of fuels due to a wet year. We do know, and it's not true just here in California, but across much of the globe, the ingredients for fire are pretty similar. You need to have enough fuel on the landscape. You need those fuels to be dry enough, and you need ignitions. And when those three factors come into alignment, particularly where there's some additional weather, it is very challenging, like Adam mentioned, for suppression to contain them, especially when it's spread across such a broad geographic range.
Adam, you spent a lot of time working with the U.S. Forest Service overseeing prescribed fire and fuel management for the Sierra Forest. I'm curious about your thoughts about the politics that have been injected into the conversation about wildfire. I mean, like everything else in our society, it has become political, with some blaming climate change and others arguing that these fires are a function of poor forest management. I would assume, given your experience, that you would reject the simplification of this fire outbreak as simply, you know, one or the other situation. Can you just speak to that debate going on right now?
Yeah. I guess the first thing that comes to mind is, you know, the causes of these, you know, these massive fires that we're having now isn't from one group or another. Like, we have to think about our culture as a whole and how we started integrating into the landscape 100 years ago. Before we were here, you know, a lot of people know that fire was natural on the landscape. When you start introducing urban interface and some of the resource values out there that you're trying to protect, and the reaction is to start saving, you know, or putting out fires, then you start kind of building on it. But it wasn't, you know, the land management agencies alone that said, hey, we need to put the fires out. It's all the kind of more economics there that's too, is the users of the forest, the wood products that come out, the hydroelectric, you know. And so it's for our culture and our societies that we've come to this point that we're at, because we all have different needs of the land. And meanwhile, the land management agencies are attempting to do their best. And there's policies such as NEPA that put sideboards on how you go about doing the treatments on the landscape. And then that kind of causes a little bit of difficulty to implement some of these fuel strategies and on and on. So I think, you know, we just need to look at it in the fact that, you know, we have our culture in the West here and on how we manage the land, how we interact with the landscape. And because, you know, we have these things that we value, it makes it difficult to, you know, let's say, you know, add prescribed fire to the landscape. So one example would be if there were no houses or there was no infrastructure or values, you know, that we could damage through prescribed fire, we could let prescribed fire just go across the Central Sierras like it used to, and it wouldn't have any threat, and we could manage it appropriately. But the challenge becomes is there's a lot of intermix in there. And so it doesn't make it as easy to apply these broad applications of prescribed fire. And so that's no fault of anybody in particular. That just has to do with the way that we enjoy our society and utilize the forests. So it's it is difficult to hear that people think it's one group or another that's the causal factor of this, you know, when in reality it has to do with, you know, many different things and many different interests on the landscape. And, you know, a lot of times it really kind of comes back to economics as well, because everybody out there has the will to do these types of treatments. I wouldn't say there's any doubt against that. We all have the will to do the treatments from the agency.
And when you say treatments, though, do you mean prescribed burns?
I'll say prescribed burns, you know, mechanical thinning, vegetation management, all those things that will reduce the fuel loadings and make the forest more healthy. There's not a lack of will. It's just, you know, a lot of times it's tough economically to do that when the timber that needs to come off the hillside has nowhere to go, you know, for the mills or biomass or whatever. You know, a lot of the bug killed trees had no value. And so they had nowhere that they could go and take them. So it kind of becomes an economic issue as well.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Valley Edition. We're talking about wildfire with John Abatsoglu, Associate Professor of Climatology at UC Merced, Mike Thune, Fire Communication and Education Specialist at the Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks, and Adam Hernandez, Wildland Fire Technology Instructor at Reedley College. Mike, I would like to turn the conversation to you. This moment with the air quality and just the overwhelming number of fires that are popping up throughout the West feels apocalyptic. But I think something that I would like to keep in mind, or I'm trying to keep in mind, is that fire is part of the ecosystem of the forest. And so can you tell us about what these fires are going to mean for our forest moving forward? It feels like everything's just burning to the ground, but what actually will come next?
So when it comes to how we look at the forest, especially during fires and then afterwards, a lot of the things that Adam mentioned and how we manage the forest has to be looked at differently. As Adam was mentioning, fires have burned in the Sierra Nevada for thousands of years. And one of the challenges that we face is a broader public acceptance of how we need to manage the fires, both during these large-scale wildfires, and then not only after how we have to manage the ecosystem, but then also what it means for the next time. And part of that comes into is what is right for those areas. Currently in Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks, we have two wildfires. One's called the Rattlesnake and the other one's called the Moraine. And both those wildfires were naturally caused, meaning they're started by lightning, and are only being staffed in a very minimal way, using what we call a confine and contain strategy, which is using rocks and other natural barriers. One of the reasons we're doing that decision strategy is because there's no threat to life or property with those fires. So we don't want to put valuable resources right now on fires that are literally in designated wilderness instead of having those firefighters work where there are those wildland urban interfaces that Adam was mentioning, because there is threats to life and property, especially when it comes to fires like the Creek or the SQF complex. At the same time, it's not until after the fire that we really know what the fire did or didn't do. I think, generally speaking, people have this vision of almost like the opening from the TV show Bonanza, where everything in that fire footprint is completely burned. And that's not always the case. Some of it has to do with where it's burning, the types of vegetation it's burning through, has to do with what the weather's like that very day, what the wind's like, and the overall amount of vegetation there is, as both the other panels were mentioning. The other part of it, it comes to, well, what does this mean for us long term? And within the National Park Service, we've been doing prescribed burning in the Sierra Nevada for over 50 years. And one of the things that we're starting to see change is the acceptance of that prescribed burning. And one of the biggest barriers to that acceptance is the air quality. So we generally find that it's in the fall or the spring is when our best windows are to do that prescribed burning, because that's also when we have the people available to do it. At the same time, we do get pushback from the public, because we have been starting looking into our prescribed burning program for this fall. Are we going to actually do prescribed burning this fall when there's already been so much particulate matter put up into the atmosphere this year with these wildfires? Because people do want a breathing break, so to speak. They want that opportunity to have those clear skies. But the reality is, unless we do that proactive management and we have a program where we are able to allow nature to take its course in some of these fires, or to have more prescribed burning, we're just going to be playing catch up. And that catch up is going to come in the in the face of large-scale wildfires.
John, do you think this fire might lead to a cultural change when it comes to our relationship as a society with prescribed burns and forest management?
Yeah, I mean, I think Mike hit it on the head there, right? We right now are in the midst of what, our fourth or fifth week of just oppressive air quality here across the San Joaquin Valley. And realistically, this is across much of California. And one of the questions that I think the public is going to have to ask themselves is, how do they want their smoke? Do they want it all at once? Or are they okay with having a little bit of smoke in the off season when there actually is going to be a little bit more mixing? So I think this is potentially a turning point in sort of viewing both the public acceptance of prescribed fire and also realizing that not all fire is bad. There's fire is a natural part of our landscape, but what we really want to do is sort of have more control over what burns. And that is to reduce some of the sort of the fires that really impact people, either directly or indirectly through air quality. So this is an interesting turning point. We will see what's going to happen. I think we do know what we need to do. Like Adam was mentioning, we know what we're supposed to do on the landscape. It does seem like it's a lot of it's about economics, in that in order to do this, it really requires a massive effort, and it's not a one-time effort. It's continual effort, putting more resources for sort of fire prevention.
Adam, do you agree?
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. You know, I think the turning point needs to be that we just embrace this is what we need to do to move forward as a culture. And, you know, the challenge with a lot of the land management agencies is just the institutional barriers that exist that slow down the will to do the work. And we need to be more flexible in the way that we go about doing it. We need to be, more fruitful with the resources that we put forth, whether it be money or personnel or, organizational structures to move this fuels reduction program forward. And I think that's the way. You know, we need to be proactive. The prevention element is the pre-treatments, right? If you do the pre-treatments, you know, maybe you'll start reducing the costs of the suppression if you start making those larger gains.
So as you all have mentioned, there are so many elements that have contributed to this moment related to weather and drought and conditions in the forest, and it goes on and on and on. But I would like to talk again about climate change a bit more. You know, John, we're used to talking about climate change as something that we collectively should try to prevent. But of course, we're past that point now. It's happening. So while we can talk about how to slow climate change still and how we could reverse the trends, it seems that we also need to be having a conversation about how do we adapt to the current reality. And from that perspective, what should we be doing in acknowledgement that we are going to continue to have these series of extreme drought periods?
Yeah, and this is certainly a question that is going to have a different answer depending on exactly where we're talking and what sector we're talking, but we're talking about fire. So from the fire side, we do know that the deck is stacked for more fire in the future. Not every year. Not every year is going to look like this, even in a warming climate. We're going to have years like we saw last year where the conditions were not aligned. And so those actually may be years to implement a little bit more of these preventative strategies. Those are years where maybe the public is not sort of smoked out by fire for, you know, months on end. And those may be years where we have conditions that are conducive to conducting more of these prescribed fire treatments. I think that you're right in that we are already in the midst of climate change. Things are going to continue to hasten. We can do things to adapt, at least to mitigate some of the impacts as it pertains to fire. And that's primarily going to occur through sort of the fuel side of the equation.
This is Mike, and I absolutely agree with what John's saying, because when we have those years where there is less wildfire activity, we are looking at options across all land management agencies to be those active management fire people. And we like to start referring to ourselves not just as firefighters, but fire managers. And a good example was last year in Sequoia National Park, we were able to conduct the Sherman prescribed burn. And not only was it a really important prescribed burn because of its location in Giant Forest next to the General Sherman tree, but when we did that prescribed burn after the 4th of July and one of the busiest part of one of the busiest national parks in the nation. We talked to over 10,000 people in just a week while we were doing that prescribed burn. And we were fortunate that we had no complaints. And I hit on that moment because you're starting to see from not only our local visitors and residents, but you're also starting to see that public acceptance from our international visitors. Nearly 40% of our visitors to Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks come from other countries where fire may not be as big of an issue as it is here in the Western United States. And so we kind of look at some of that education, but it's also when those opportunities exist. Because our first job foremost is the protection of life and property. And as we look at climate change and we look at what's become from fire season to now is referred to as a fire year, it's finding those windows in those places. And sometimes we get asked questions about, well, can we do it in January or February when there's less visitation or the air is better? But as any firefighter will tell you, it's really hard to conduct a prescribed burn when it's covered with snow. And so, unfortunately, sometimes those best opportunities to do those prescribed burns are when the weather is more ideal for either public visitation or just tourism in general.
So we just have a minute before we need to wrap up. But Adam, I'd like to give you the last word. You've talked about that there is the will to do more prescribed burns. I wonder if you could talk about the resources to do that work. Are there sufficient staffing and resources necessary to do prescribed burns at the rate at which the experts think needs to happen?
I would say at the pace and scale that we need to apply fire to the landscape, we don't have enough. If you look at any agency, you know, the way that they operate is they have their firefighters that fight fires all summer long. And then typically when fire season starts to die down, you have your shoulder seasons, which is when, you know, the prescribed burning occurs. So it's, you know, it becomes very challenging with a seasonal workforce to try to squeeze in a prescribed burn on these shoulder seasons when firefighters have been taxed all summer long. And so we need to develop a different system where we can meet that need and we have the people to do it. And one thing just to add to the climate, I guess one of the silver linings with, you know, the climates warming up the way they are is it's going to lengthen our shoulder seasons that we have. So we should have longer burn windows that go further into the winter that we can utilize. The challenge is the personnel and the access to the people during that time of the season. Our fire season and our systems aren't designed to have that bulk of firefighters all the way through the winter. So I think those are the things that we need to look at, and that's the way that we will be able to keep up with that pace and scale that's needed.
Adam Hernandez, Mike Thune, John Abatsoglu, thank you so much for being with us.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. As we enter the final months of the 2020 election, public radio station KCRW is taking a look at a pair of neighbors that couldn't be more different, at least on the surface. We're talking about two neighboring counties, Kern and Los Angeles. One leans conservative, the other liberal, but there's some surprising common ground. Reporter Matt Gillum starts off this new series, called Red County, Blue County, in the rapidly growing city of Bakersfield.
The midday sun is searing downtown Bakersfield as Andre Gonzalez takes me on a walking tour of the city's core. Having just come from a meeting, he's wearing long pants as we pound the pavement in the 100-degree heat. He shrugs it off. After all, he's used to it. He grew up here.
You know, Bakersfield was a place that a lot of my friends and high school, you know, classmates, it was a place where we wanted to get out of. You know, we wanted to get to a bigger city. We wanted to go off to college and get a job elsewhere. There was a definite small town feel to this community.
Like a lot of millennials here, he went away to college in a liberal city, Berkeley in his case, but came home to the Central Valley.
I wanted to be part of a transformation of our community. I recognized that we were growing. That wasn't the question. The question was, how are we going to grow? What will Bakersfield look like over the next 20 years, 30 years? And I wanted to be part of that decision-making process.
Gonzalez is indeed playing a role in shaping the city's change. The young Democrat was elected to the city council in 2016 and is one of two Latinos serving on the seven-member body. As we walk through downtown, Gonzalez points to a new residential development.
There is a demand for more housing within the urban core, and that's a change. That is a shift from what we've seen in Bakersfield.
With density and urbanization rising in the Kern County seat, I ask Gonzalez about political change. He tells me a story he believes is evidence of Bakersfield's slow fade from ruby red to blushing purple.
In 2018, the city council put forth a measure to increase the sales tax by 1 cent on the dollar. There are a lot of folks who are engaged politically, who were very cynical about the fact that the voters within Bakersfield would actually increase their taxes. Because, you know, many people think this city is staunchly conservative. And what they mean is, you know, also fiscally conservative. They're not going to raise taxes. Don't raise my taxes. No way, no how. On election night, we got the results. Measure N, as we call it, was actually failing by several thousand votes. As more votes came in and were counted, we ended up winning by 97 votes. Okay, there's over 100,000 voters who participated in this election, but we won.
That initiative, Measure N, generates about $58 million for the city every year, with the funds going to spur economic development, maintain public safety, and address homelessness. If that sounds familiar, LA County voters also decided to tax themselves, passing a sales tax called Measure H in 2017. According to Gonzalez, the like-minded Measure N squeaking by in Bakersfield shows
that we're not this just blindly conservative community. That people are, yeah, they may have conservative principles here, but they're also open-minded. They're going to think about what's in the best interest of the community overall.
On the other side of the Kern River and nestled against the 99 freeway is a diner called Zingo's. It's exactly what you're imagining. It's got a great neon sign and a wraparound countertop. Although it's a short drive from downtown, the views among the truckers and other regulars are a world away from those of Andre Gonzalez. It's the kind of place where waitresses aren't averse to calling you Shug or Hun, but the staff does have an aversion to masks. They're not wearing the mandatory face coverings, and neither is customer Bobby Lynch.
I believe that a lot of the COVID scare is politically motivated. A lot of it will be cured about November 6th, but that's just my opinion.
Lynch looks at ease as he sits inside the warm diner, sporting a gray t-shirt and faded Hooters visor. As for his politics...
I'm in Kern County. I pretty much vote Republican down the board.
And that includes Trump. In the last presidential election, 53% of Kern County voters supported Donald Trump. In L.A. County, just 22% did. But the two neighbors weren't always so different. Part of the conservative legacy that runs up and down the Central Valley can be traced to the 1930s. When the Dust Bowl killed the farmland of the Midwest, countless families left the plains for California's agricultural heartland. Their know-how turned the valley into some of the world's most productive soil, and their politics continue to shape the area. By the time the Dust Bowl and the Depression were sealing California's place in the popular imagination, L.A. and Kern were already heading in different directions, says Professor William Devereaux, the director of the Huntington USC Institute on California and the West.
They diverge, probably right at that moment, around 1880 to 1910, where the metropolitan future of one place is fairly, you can see it, and the less growth-obsessed, less of a juggernaut future of a place like Kern County is also, I think, by then, in the cards.
Eventually, L.A. would grow to be the nation's most populous county with an economy that includes international trade and Hollywood. Meanwhile, Kern County stuck to the land. Under the bounty of its fields, vast deposits of oil attract some of the biggest fossil fuel companies in the world to the Central Valley. Despite Trump's advocacy for America's farmers and his belief that fossil fuels are critical to the future of the nation, Bobby Lynch says his policies haven't helped oil and ag-heavy Kern County.
I don't think he has a chance to help this region. You got Governor Newsom that wants to get rid of all fossil fuels. He doesn't want any agriculture to happen. They don't ship water to Central Valley farmers that they've paid their water rations for. It almost seems like the state-level government doesn't want any business.
As we continue to talk, Lynch, who's a lifelong Bakersfield resident, outlines a vague societal decline due to a rise in homelessness, more crime, and a sense that there are no more hard and fast rules. Lynch no longer feels at home here in this conservative corner of California.
I will probably move back to the Midwest. Right now I'm staying around for family members that are too old and need some help. But if I can convince them to leave, we'll all go together. I've gotten to the point where I just would like to be out of California.
The former trucker may be planning to hit the road permanently, but thousands of people, including a good amount of Angelenos, are flocking to Bakersfield and stoking its urban growth. In the newly hip part of downtown Bakersfield called East Chester, Cafe Smitten stands out. The bright blue brick building used to be an auto shop, but now it serves pour-over coffee and eclectic breakfast fare. With chic industrial design and a full complement of succulents, Smitten wouldn't be out of place in Silver Lake. I'm running a few minutes late, and Bob Smith, another member of the local city council, is already sitting on the cafe's patio when I arrive. Smith rode his bicycle, is wearing shorts and flip-flops, and has a tan on par with George Hamilton. If you can't tell, he's pretty laid back. This is how he describes himself.
I'm an old white guy. I'm in the minority these days, which is fine with me.
He's not wrong. Both the city of Bakersfield and Kern County are now majority Latino. White residents make up about a third of the population. When Smith moved to town in 1980, the city only had about 100,000 residents. Over the last 40 years, it's gotten to nearly 400,000 and has become California's ninth largest city.
You know, the whole valley is the most affordable place in California. We get a lot of people from LA.
You'll be hard-pressed to find better housing prices than in Kern County. According to Zillow, the median price of a home listed in the county is $255,000. Meanwhile, it's just about $700,000 for LA County. That definitely was a factor when Smith's daughter, Stacy, decided to move back to the Central Valley after living in Manhattan for 8 years with her husband.
When we were talking about leaving New York, Bakersfield just started to sound good and make sense for what we were looking for. We wanted to start a family. We wanted to purchase a home. We wanted more space. And Bakersfield just fit the criteria that we were looking for.
Stacy Bitten and her husband took the elements of the coffee shops and restaurants they'd frequented in New York and brought them here by opening Cafe Smitten. It's a hit, and with several boutiques launching close by, it's changed the vibe of the street.
This doesn't feel like we're in Bakersfield. And I'm like, well, actually, the really cool thing is, like, you are in Bakersfield, and this is possible in Bakersfield. Like, you are in your hometown. You don't have to drive to have a cool experience. Have it in your own hometown.
As more big city stuff comes to town, and more big city people, I ask the father and daughter if that also means some big city views are beginning to roost in Bakersfield. Stacy says she prefers staying out of politics. As for her elected official dad, at first he says he doesn't like getting hung up in that Republican, Democrat, conservative, liberal stuff, but eventually he puts politics in its place.
I'm a man of faith. I'm a family man. I'm a man that wants to give back to the community. I am a man who likes bicycling, who cares about, you know, people's health, and I'm also a registered Republican. So my tribe is my family, not conservative red Republican. I have one son-in-law that was born in Ecuador, another son-in-law that was born in Israel. My son's partner was born in Russia. So it's a very diverse life these days for most everybody.
Smith is many things, including a Republican. The same goes for Bakersfield. It remains a place with conservative values, but local politics skew toward pragmatic rather than partisan. Facing a global pandemic, a tanking economy, and an election unlike any we've ever seen, the no-nonsense approach of Bakersfield could offer lessons to both red and blue counties alike. Over the coming weeks, we'll explore the similarities and differences between LA and Kern when it comes to immigration, oil, and the Black Lives Matter movement, and what it could tell us about Election Day. For KCRW, I'm Matt Gillum reporting in Bakersfield.
And I'm proud to be an Okie from Muskogee. A place where even squares can have a ball. We still wave old glory down at the courthouse. White lightning's still the biggest.
You're listening to Valley Edition. We'll be back with more stories after the break.
Hey everyone, it's Joe Moore, President and GM of Valley Public Radio. Look at a picture of a living room from the 1930s or 40s, and you'll see it. Right there, in the middle of the room, in all its Art Deco glory, a giant radio. It was state-of-the-art technology back then, And while tabletops, transistors, boomboxes, and Walkmen have all come and gone since then, radio is more relevant now and in more places than ever. Because while you might not even have an actual radio in your home, today Valley Public Radio is everywhere. It's on your smart speaker, it's on your smart TV, it's on your laptop and tablet, your phone, maybe even your watch. It's literally everywhere you go, even if you're staying at home more than normal. So remember, start your day with Valley Public Radio, home or away, at kvpr.org.
We've been in lockdown for 6 months, so you really should be thinking about your pandemic memoir. Jesse Klein sure has.
Mine is going to be called Feelings and How to Eat Them All Up.
I'm Peter Sagal. Fix yourself a nice bowl of angst and sit down with us as we talk with Titus Burgess in this week's News Quiz from NPR.
Listen to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Saturday at 11 on Valley Public Radio.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Over the last few weeks, a lot has changed in the world of COVID-19. Our local case numbers have been improving. And while the state has streamlined its guidelines for reopening, not all counties feel like it's a fair system. Here to discuss this and more is FM89's health reporter, Carrie Klein. Carrie, welcome back.
Hi, Kathleen.
As always, tell us what's new in the COVID-19 outlook for our region.
Well, what's new is that we actually have a lot of good news. So new cases are slowing. They have been for a little over a month now. So, I mean, in broad strokes, the local peak in terms of new cases was in late July. And since then, new daily cases have been steadily falling. However, COVID-19 related deaths have been a little bit later in slowing, because there's usually a lag between when, you know, we get kind of a bump in reported cases and then a bump in related deaths. But those numbers are also dropping well, those fatalities. We also have fewer patients in hospitals and ICUs. And according to state data, we're down to about a third the number of COVID patients that were in hospitals that we had in late July. I also heard this from Dr. Kenny Bond. He is an associate dean of the UCSF Fresno Medical School, and he's a physician in the emergency department at Community Regional Medical Center. And he says it is clear that there are fewer patients coming in with COVID-19 emergencies.
The way we notice it the most in the ER is actually that the amount of COVID holds, like the amount of total COVID patients affects how many patients are waiting in the ER, or sometimes we have patients waiting in the hallway, we're almost always at over capacity. And so that in particular is where we notice it the most, where that has kind of relented recently in the last 2 weeks, if you look at our numbers.
Of course, these trends could all head back in the wrong direction just as quickly as they improved. And health officials are still waiting to see if there will be a bump in cases from Labor Day.
And the state has changed its reopening guidelines for businesses and schools. What does that mean?
Right. So we no longer have the county monitoring list, which we had talked about in many of these updates before. It's now called a blueprint for a safer economy. And the data on this are much less convoluted, at least they're meant to be. And so every county is given a color code based on how widespread the pandemic is there. Right now, all counties in the FM89 coverage area are in the worst tier, that's purple, for widespread activity, except for Mariposa County, which is two tiers ahead in the orange category. And there are different sets of rules for businesses and schools reopening based on which tier you're in. And so for most of us here in the Valley, not a lot changed immediately with this new blueprint, except that salons were allowed to reopen indoors with some modifications. Most other businesses stayed the same. And as opposed to the old system, which used kind of a big matrix of data for determining how a county is doing, the state now is only using two data metrics. And one is called it's the case rate, which is the number of cases per capita, and the positivity rate, which is the proportion of those tests that come back positive. And so this, you know, this whole blueprint was designed to simplify how a county's progress is measured and how a county can graduate to a new tier.
But like so much public health messaging in this pandemic, your reporting has found that the state's new system did not necessarily simplify things.
That's correct, unfortunately. And one example is that there are some rules about how long a county needs to stay in each tier before moving. You know, there's like a 3-week wait, and then there's a 2-week clock that kind of gets started once you hit certain benchmarks. And even on a media call earlier this week, health officials in Fresno County were a little bit stumped on whether the clock had actually started on being able to reopen some schools and businesses. And, you know, there were a few other wrinkles as well.
Well, and from what I understand, one big wrinkle has upset Kern County.
That's right. So shortly after announcing this new blueprint system, the state did complicate one of those two metrics I mentioned, the overall case rate in a county. And basically, Governor Newsom said that the state is going to adjust counties' case rates based on how much testing they're doing. So let's say if a county is testing at a higher rate than the median, so that means if they're testing more people per capita or per population than the median of all counties in the state, then that county gets a boost and the state will lower its case rate, and that will help it advance to the next tier. But that also means that those counties that are testing below the state median, so they're testing less than many other counties are, they will get penalized and their case rates get inflated, making it harder for them to move to a better tier. The two counties hit hardest by this inflation are Riverside and Kern. And boy, does Kern County feel that this is unfair. In a media call yesterday, Chief Administrative Officer Ryan Alsop very forcefully spoke out against what he says is the governor moving the goalposts.
The statewide testing rate average is a moving target and is not based on any clinically relevant data or information. This new criteria unnecessarily burdens our residents, parents, and children, further slowing business and school reopening, and it unnecessarily and arbitrarily penalizes counties who have little to no control over voluntary and individual decision-making related to testing for COVID-19.
He said the county had been seeing progress lately in its fight against COVID-19, and to be penalized like this is like a slap in the face.
Why did state officials do this?
I mean, in an email, the public health department said that, ensuring adequate testing volume is critical to identifying COVID-19 cases in the community and interrupting transmission of the disease. Fair enough. The idea is that a county can say it has a low case rate, but if it's hardly doing any testing, then the rate's probably not accurate. However, the state hasn't actually set a target testing rate. It's just comparing all counties against the median testing rate. And as Ryan Alsop pointed out, that is a constantly moving target rather than an objective goal.
Fair enough. What is Kern County going to do about it?
Well, the county says they are working on a plan to encourage more testing. They do already have a lot of testing sites set up that are being underutilized and have been underutilized for a little bit of time. They also have a mobile testing unit driving around the county. They're trying to publicize where it will be to encourage people to go there. And meanwhile, County Administrative Officer Ryan Alsop has said they will be encouraging county employees to go out and get tested often. He says they will try and exert control where they can, which is over their own county employees, knowing full well that they have no control over other employers and what they do with their employees.
Wow, that is fascinating. Carrie, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. We all know how hard it can be to get accurate information about news, politics, and the election, especially when it comes to stories on social media. Well, every week, Capital Public Radio will be fact-checking stories and reporting on misinformation in its new series, Can You Handle the Truth? Here's Cap Radio's PolitiFact reporter, Chris Nichols, speaking with Cap Radio's Steve Milne.
Chris, it's been a busy week. You've worked on fact checks dealing with the Postal Service, wildfires, and President Trump's visit to California. Let's start with the one you did on a postcard that was mailed out nationwide by the Postal Service, but led to some confusion for voters.
That's right. This card landed in mailboxes last week, and it advises people to plan ahead if they want to vote by mail, which is definitely good advice. But it also asks voters to request their mail-in ballot 15 days before Election Day. And that's caused confusion because a new state law in California already requires counties to automatically send out mail-in ballots. So if you're a registered voter and you've participated in recent elections, you don't need to make any request at all. Election officials in Sacramento and Yolo counties even released statements last week telling voters that the advice from the Postal Service about requesting a ballot just doesn't apply to most voters here in California.
Okay, well, there's also been misinformation on social media about the cause of the wildfires, both here and in Oregon and Washington. What's PolitiFact finding on that topic?
My colleagues at PolitiFact in D.C. checked this out, and they found a host of false social media claims, all of which blamed Antifa for intentionally starting these fires, especially up in Oregon. Now, Antifa is a loose and broad coalition of left-wing activists. They've been a big part of the racial justice demonstrations in Portland this summer. But there's no evidence that Antifa started any of these fires on the West Coast.
What about law enforcement? What are they saying about these claims?
Both fire and law enforcement officials, including Portland's FBI office, have all debunked these rumors.
And finally, Chris, you fact-checked President Donald Trump's visit to Sacramento this week. What did you find?
Well, I focused on what was a really striking exchange the president had with California Secretary for Natural Resources, Wade Crowfoot. And Crowfoot urged the president to acknowledge the role of climate change in making the fires worse. We have some sound from that. First, you'll hear Crowfoot, and then you'll hear a couple of claims by the president.
If we ignore that science and sort of put our head in the sand and think it's all about vegetation management, we're not going to succeed together protecting Californians.
Okay. It'll start getting cooler.
You just watch. I wish science agreed with you.
Hey, well, I don't think science knows, actually.
Well, starting with Trump's claim that it's going to get cooler, climate scientists say there's just no evidence to support that. The consensus among them is that the climate is warming, that climate change is a key factor in making these fires worse, and that we should also expect more days of extreme heat and fire danger.
President Trump also talked about forest management, which he says is the way to prevent wildfires. Now, you've actually looked at that before.
Well, the president has over and over talked about clearing trees and even raking leaves in California, and he did that again in Sacramento. And he's not wrong that forest management is an important part of preventing these massive fires. California officials agree on that. But experts say it's just one element. The other big things are urban sprawl and, of course, climate change. And finally, while both the state and federal governments are responsible for managing the forests, it's the federal government that owns nearly 60% of these forests in California, and that's a point that the president just doesn't mention when he talks about forest management.
That was Cap Radio's new series, Can You Handle the Truth?, with PolitiFact California reporter Chris Nichols and Steve Milne. And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. And we'd love to hear from you, especially your experiences around the pandemic. Send us a voice memo on our app. Just hit the audience feedback icon and record. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Laura Satsui, Carrie Klein, and Madi Bolaños. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, acknowledging the vital work of local public health departments to keep Californians safe during the pandemic. On the web at chcf.org.